As habitats for wildlife in Iowa shrink, humans find themselves coming into contact with wild animals more often. When there's a problem, they can call Iowa State University's Extension Wildlife Specialist. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, my guest is wildlife biologist Rebecca Christoffel. We'll talk about what she does as Iowa State University's Extension Wildlife Specialist, educating the public, training master conservationists, and defending the unhuggables. She has a particular weakness for snakes. Today, you'll also have a chance to ask her your questions. Send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, my guest is Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel. And it has been a long time since we've been given you the opportunity to call in with any wildlife-related question that you have. Today is your day for that. But before we get to calls, we're going to find out exactly what an ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist does. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you, Charity?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here and to put down my thoughts about what it's like to be a wildlife extension specialist.
Well, tell us what your job description is.
Well, my job description, I have a three-way split, so 70% of my time is meant to be spent on extension work, 20% on research, and 10% on teaching. So right now it's spring semester and I'm teaching interpretation or how to be a naturalist on Tuesdays and Thursdays, which is great fun. I have a number of graduate research students who are conducting projects in Iowa. And then I do my regular old extension work, which I say regular old, but, you know, you're answering questions from the public, you're answering questions from agencies, partnering with lots of organizations, and trying to make sure that people have the materials they need in order to deal effectively with human-wildlife interactions.
Do you also spend time preparing publications for Extension as well?
I do, and I've gotten a few out in the 3 years that I've been here, and right now we're working on a whole series of, I call them life tracks or wild tracks, and they're each a little, 2 to 4 page publication about all of the native wildlife species in Iowa, and we're starting out with the mammals. I have an undergraduate student working with me on those, and she's also an accomplished artist, so she's been doing some illustrations as well. And we're looking forward to getting those up on our Wild Tracks website shortly.
Well, terrific. And when you talk about interacting with the public, of course, you get a lot of questions from people, just like we will be getting this hour.
Right. You never know what it's going to be.
Right. But do you also do educational programs for groups?
I do. We have the Master Conservationist Program, which I don't actually do a lot of the teaching in, but I coordinate that program and help with curriculum development. But then I also go out and give my own programs to folks anywhere from the Audubon Society to older and wiser learners at the County Conservation Board. I do an awful lot with the naturalists in the County Conservation Board system. So they have workshops every spring and fall. And I try to present at least once a year and to also provide materials to them that they can then, I call it tweak or refine for their own use with their audiences. But I work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the State Department of Natural Resources to make sure that they have the most recent or newest information on issues like white-nose syndrome in bats.
You mentioned the Master Conservationist Program, and I think a lot of us have heard about Master Gardeners, but what is a Master Conservationist?
Well, a Master Conservationist, and I regret the term master, it's really the first step in the journey, but this basically is a program that is designed for people who are interested in learning more about our place in Iowa. So you learn about the geology of the state and why certain rock formations or certain types of plants grow in an area. You know, Iowa is so cool with the Lus Hills. I mean, you have to go all the way to China if you want to, you know, see that land formation anywhere else. So to me, that's really unique. They learn about water and waterways, and they learn about energy and sustainable farming, wildlife, wildlife diversity. You know, why should we care how many different kinds of animals can live in an area and what that means for our quality of life? So it's the first step. They get 32 hours of classroom training. And when I say classroom, I mean that very loosely. We spend an awful lot of time outside, actually visiting sites and on the ground. In the past, we've had Iowa Water training as a part of the Master Conservationist Program. So we get people out on the landscape doing water quality testing in streams near their homes or where they recreate. It's a great opportunity. In return, they give 32 hours of volunteer time. Once they've completed those volunteer hours, they become a certified Master Conservationist.
And what does that mean? What can someone use that for?
Well, it is one way for the County Conservation Board or for Iowa Department of Natural Resources, et cetera, to know something that you've got some background information. One of the things that we've done in the last year is we've developed a new web interface for our master conservationists and for our partner organizations who are looking for trained volunteers to help. And so they can, our partner organizations, can send me information that I then post up on site so that folks who are perhaps, say, in Cerro Gordo County know that there's somebody looking for volunteers in the area, and they can contact the organization directly and fulfill some of their volunteer hours. Likewise, that organization may find that they get a lifelong volunteer out of the deal. In the past, people had to send in paper sheets to report their hours. We now have an online hours entry interface so that once somebody puts in the required number of volunteer hours, it prompts an email to be sent to me saying, hey, send them their certificate and congratulate them, which is great. So it's all pretty automated, which helps a lot. I came on board 8 weeks after the major reorganization of extension in this state. So I've had to learn how to do more with less.
that's a message we've heard from a lot of people in extension.
Yep.
There's also a program that you've been involved in called Nature Mapping. What is that?
Yeah, I inherited the Nature Mapping program. That's something that Jim Pease and Jason O'Brien were very, very instrumental. They brought it to Iowa. I think it's a fabulous program. Unfortunately, when I inherited it, it had a lot of broken pieces. And so we needed to get the website fixed and the database fixed. But now we're working on reimagining that program so that it is more projects-based and that there is a mentor that works with folks in each county on specific wildlife issues. I haven't gotten as far with that program yet, still trying to raise some funds and interest with partners to get that reimagined. But now that Master Conservationist program has really moved forward in terms of infrastructure, I think we can start going to work on nature mapping.
And what is your vision for it once you get all the pieces put together?
Once we get all the pieces put together, what I really see it as, yes, it could still be that people go out on their own properties and monitor wildlife populations and report their sightings to the Iowa DNR or whatever the appropriate agency or organization is. But I want to see a more close tie with schools. So working with teachers, working with classes, it's a great way to get young people turned on to science and ecology and for them to better understand how everything fits together and how we are responsible to be stewards of the land, of the environment in which we live. And so I think this is a fabulous way to get kids outdoors, get them more physically active, pique that curiosity. You know, the more I learn, the more I know I don't know, and the more I want to learn. And so that's how nature mapping actually happens in the state of Washington, where it started. And in some cases, they have actually been able to produce peer-reviewed publications from a third-grade classroom that discovered some very interesting information about horned toads in Washington and the fact that juveniles have a different diet than the adults have, which had some important implications for farming practices.
So I can imagine people listening to you talking about that and getting very excited. What are you looking for right now to get to that vision? Are there ways that people in the public can help?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, just knowing that people are interested and that there is a need for this program, I think, is very helpful. I am going to apply for some funding through various organizations. But the fact that we have this new STEM initiative statewide, I think, lends itself to incorporation of this programming. It delivers on a lot of the objectives of increasing STEM involvement with classes of various ages and producing youngsters or young individuals that are prepared to, A, what perhaps may be most important, is to be really discriminating consumers of information that they get through the newspaper, through their textbooks, etc., because they'll be a much more scientifically literate set of people having actually been engaged in the scientific process.
And we are going to take a break here in just a moment, but you also mentioned that part of your work is doing your own research. What do you focus on?
I focus primarily on the human dimensions of wildlife management. So right now, for the first time ever, we're going to have information on all of the different kinds of citizens that live in Iowa in terms of their orientations, their value orientations toward wildlife. In the past, we've only had information on a group of agricultural producers, but really next to nothing about from our urban population, which now is about 61%. So that research is just finishing up right now, and we're getting publications out, we're trying to get them out the door. And my student is prepared to defend on April 12th. Yes, go Andrew. but we're also looking into what sorts of materials would be appropriate for older female agricultural landowners. I'm working with the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network and e-resources group on that project. US EPA Region 7 has funded this work, looking specifically at producing a curriculum for conservation professionals to work with older women landowners for restoring wetlands.
All right, we are going to take a short break. My guest today is Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel. And now is your opportunity to ask your questions. Any wildlife-related questions that have been plagueing you, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel. And you have an opportunity now to ask Rebecca your questions. A lot of us come into contact with wildlife now as subdivisions move further and further out from the center of towns and habitats for wild animals in Iowa tend to shrink. We do come into contact with wild animals quite frequently, and you can ask your questions today, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Joe in Boone County sent an email, Rebecca, and I think I can guess the answer to this because I did mention earlier your weakness for snakes. But Joe wants to know if you're familiar with the website herpnet.net. It may be a great resource for folks who call about the state's reptile and amphibian population. It has actual local photos, range maps, and descriptions of all of Iowa's snakes, turtles, lizards, frogs, toads, and salamanders.
Yep, we generally, I do a lot of referring to that website, and that was actually put together by a fabulous field herpetologist, Jeff LeClaire. He actually lives in Minnesota but does a lot of work in Iowa. And yes, that is the best resource that we have right now for helping folks with that sort of question.
And you have a number of snakes yourself, right?
I do. I love to go out and give programs with my animals. One of the best ways to help people to gain a little familiarity, and familiarity, you know, you've heard of that social numbing. You know, we hear about people getting killed somewhere and you can't put a face with a name, so it doesn't bother you so much. And I often think this happens to snakes. They get a bad rap, excuse the pun, and so people think that they're not, you know, valuable animals. Then you get to meet one up close and personal. And my animals are very personable. They travel on me as I'm presenting, and they're doing a lot of tongue flicking, and it's clear that they recognize who I am. So I love to give people that sort of personal encounter with this animal that oftentimes people are at least uncomfortable around. And once they've dealt with my animals and see how safe it is and how relaxed my animals are when they're out and about, it has great potential for helping people overcome their fear or feelings of disgust towards snakes.
Along the same lines with a... Well, snakes aren't slimy, but a lot of people consider them in the same... sphere. With amphibians in Iowa, do we a lot of research about how they are changing? I know that they're one of the animals that we consider sort of to be the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are very interested, myself included, in terms of amphibian populations, because all the way back in 1989, it was first recognized that there's something going on with amphibian populations, and it's not limited to one geographic area. There are things happening all around the globe, probably most people are familiar with, but if not, there is also a fungal disease that amphibians are subject to. It's called chytridiomycosis, and that has wiped out populations in some areas. So in Iowa, there actually is some ongoing research out of the Natural Resource Ecology and Management Department, which is where I am stationed, looking at different kinds of wetlands and what those wetlands mean, how they can serve as habitat for our native amphibians. At one point, there was somebody who has been also studying amphibian populations in the oxbows and other wetland areas along the Missouri River. Unfortunately, when they had the horrible flooding there, that sort of put a damper on that research for a while, but it is ongoing.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. With me today, ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel, and Brad is on the line from Indianola. Hi, Brad.
Hi, longtime listener, first-time caller. When it warmed up recently, we had a bat drop down in our living room and found it swooping around our living room. I netted it and took it to the ISU Veterinarian Diagnostic Lab to have it tested for rabies. But what should we do when we find a bat flying around inside our house? And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
Well, so there are a couple of things. The first thing to do is if you find an animal that's come down into the living quarters, what generally has happened is that you have these animals, particularly at this time of year, overwintering in your attic. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depends, they do rouse themselves every couple of weeks. Generally, what happens is they have actual dew that forms on their fur, so that's a way that they can get a drink of water and stay hydrated during the winter. We get some warm snaps during the winter, and oftentimes that will instigate movement on the part of the bat, and they may unknowingly find their way downstairs. The best thing to do is to try to get the bat in one room. So if it's in a room, a bedroom, say you find it, you can close the door to make sure that it stays in that room. And then you can use a plastic container and a piece of cardboard to capture the bat when it's roosting on something like draperies, and you can remove the bat. Now, you're not going to remove it to the outside in January. Taking it to the wildlife care clinic at Iowa State University's veterinary school or a wildlife rehabilitator. There's the new Iowa Wildlife Center, and they overwinter some bats. There are other wildlife rehabilitators around the state who will overwinter bats. And they can keep the animal until the spring when it will be released. If there's any question as to whether or not the bat was in the house overnight and in your bedroom, then what you want to do is get the animal to, just as the caller did, get it tested for rabies. And depending on what's found, you may or may not have to get rabies shots. It's a lot less of an ordeal than it has been in the past. But it would be remiss of me to say anything other than what the Centers for Disease Control recommend. And that's basically what I've just given you.
All right. And of course, getting tested for rabies means that the animal is destroyed.
Right. There is no other way to test for rabies with these animals. That's why I say it's important if you know that the animal has just come down that evening and nobody has been potentially bitten by the animal, then it's very easy to catch the animal and get it taken to some place where it can be overwintered.
All right. Do you get that question a lot, Daniel? Rebecca?
I do get the question an awful lot, and I always feel badly. But, you know, rabies is one of those all-or-nothing propositions. So, really, we don't want to have bats in our house. It's not good for the bats, and it's not good for us. The big thing is if it happens once, then that's your cue right there to get things checked out so that it doesn't happen again, because we don't want to be killing animals unnecessarily. And what you want to do is get the bats out of the house.
All right. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Danielle is on the line next from Woodward. Hi, Danielle.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I have recently returned from the Oak Savannah Fire Conference in Dubuque, and in addition to great ideas on more work for restoring Oak Savannas, there are a lot of people from probably six different states. Among them were wildlife specialists who talked about those of us who burn brush piles in the winter when we would think we'd have the least amount of impact. I learned, sadly, that we could actually be negatively affecting box turtles, and I'm wondering if Dr. Cristobal has additional information about that. I'm at the point now where I'm probably going to deconstruct four huge brush piles that I was going to burn, and I'll probably move the location and burn them bit by bit so I don't impact box turtles.
Well, interesting. Rebecca?
Well, that's an interesting point. I have not heard of this being a problem with ornate box turtles. Ornate box turtles usually burrow down below the frost line, and so I don't know what kind of an issue there would be for ornates. Eastern box turtles might be a different story, but here in Iowa, we don't have eastern box turtles. So it sounds like I need to talk to Danielle about specifically what people have been finding. Though I will add this in, and it's something that my husband and I both are very, very interested in prairie and savanna, and he happens to study prairie insects and their relationships with different prairie plants. And oftentimes we think of burning in the winter as being sort of this nothing's going to happen, we don't have to worry about the ecosystem at all. Well, when it comes to biological diversity on prairie, it really is with the insects, more so than the plants or any other group. And many, many insects overwinter in the stems, etc., the duff of the prairie. And so when you do a winter burn, you can wipe out an awful lot of the invertebrate fauna, which are really responsible for such diversity on prairies. So that whole idea of management and when to do what, really, it's not that there's a right or a wrong answer. It has to do with scale. When we had large contiguous patches of habitat, if you went and you burned something up, it wasn't the end of the world. There were lots of other places, refugia available for these animals. Now that we generally are managing postage stamp sized pieces of habitat, it really brings to light a whole new set of challenges in terms of managing habitats for which these animals are dependent, but which management can harm.
It seems like we're learning a lot about burning management as well. It seems that in, you know, over the last 30 years, really, with the movement to reconstruct a lot of prairies, there have been a lot of small things about this burning management that we have discovered over these years that we really didn't know.
Yeah, for one, you know, we didn't know about the importance of fire as one of the disturbance forces on the landscape. We're learning more and more about the frequencies with which fires used to occur in different areas of not only Iowa, but different parts of the state. We've learned, you know, that fire suppression has really been a big problem. You know, Smokey Bear did his work very, very well. Unfortunately, that has led to huge builds up of fuel in forests and that. And so when you do get a fire in such an area, it can just be devastating, much hotter, much more likely to become a crown fire and do lots of damage than if we periodically had burns that happened that reduced fuel load. So we're learning a lot. But again, the more we learn, the more we know that we need to learn in order to use this tool, just like any other tool, responsibly.
Danielle, thank you so much for your call. Next up is Mac on the line in Knoxville. Hi, Mac.
Hi. I have a snake problem. I built a house in some woods by a lake, and ever since, we get a large number of snakes. And I was wondering if there's something you can do to discourage them from coming around your front porch.
Well, you've got a good question there. Are they around your front porch all season long, or do you get an influx at certain times of year?
It seems like certain times of the year they come up to sun. I've got a brick patio, and they come up and try to sun on the bricks.
So can you tell me, is it spring and fall, or is it midsummer?
Yeah. It's spring and fall. It's not midsummer. They seem to go away.
Yeah. Okay, well, I hate to tell you this, but you probably have built your home right in the migration corridor of snakes. Many of our snakes, what you have to understand is that good places to hibernate for snakes in this area are a rare commodity or resource. So you can't just hibernate anywhere. Snakes can't freeze solid like you've probably heard about wood frogs that can freeze solid and then thaw out in the spring. Can't do that if you're a snake. You have to avoid the frost line. So what happens is, and a lot of our snake populations haven't been very well studied, so we don't know as much about snakes as we might know about snakes. But many snakes will use the same places to hibernate year after year after year after year. They often leave something like a pheromone trail or scent trail for the youngsters to find out where is this place that you can overwinter and survive for your next opportunity to breed. So what I suspect is that your house is somewhere between where they overwinter. And then in the summer, they're going to spend most of their time around that lake or wetland area, lowland area, where there are wonderful things to eat like frogs and minnows, etc., earthworms. And so your house or your patio provides a wonderful sort of staging spot for them. And once they get all warmed up, they move on and get to the place where they're going to spend their summer. Then in the fall, they have to move back to the hibernaculum. That's the place where they're going to overwinter. And again, they rest at your place on their way. So I wonder if you could just tolerate them as they make their way through each year. I suspect it's probably just garter snakes, so not anything that's going to hurt you or your kids or anybody else. But
snakes as well.
What other kinds of snakes?
Milk.
Oh, okay, milk snakes. Yeah, those are wonderful little rodent eaters. So neither of these species are any threat to you or your family. And they're just using your place as a little staging ground to warm up and pass through probably within a couple of weeks as they make their way to their lowland area. You can try to discourage the animals by keeping lawns short, etc., not providing these places where they can hide or escape potential predators. Aerial predators are the ones they have to worry about most, things like hawks. But if they're cold and they're needing to warm up some as they make their way to the lowland area, then they're out in the open. But trying to minimize any kind of cover for them is the best way to discourage them from hanging around your buildings.
What if you put out a couple of large rocks that were away from the porch? Would that be a more attractive place for them to sun themselves than on the porch, or maybe not?
That's a great thought. If you don't already have those available, something similar to that, if not that, available. That is another way. I often say to people, because there are a lot of people who like snakes, they just don't want them around their buildings. So that if you'll provide habitat away from your buildings and then keep the landscaping around your buildings very sparse and very short, you're less likely to have the snakes there.
All right, Mac, thank you so much for your call. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. My guest today is Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel. And you are welcome to join our conversation with any wildlife-related questions you may have. Let's go to an email from Lindsay in Des Moines. And I want to mention that phone number one more time. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Lindsay in Des Moines is wondering, she said, just this last summer, I was at a park with a friend when we spotted a baby raccoon who looked as if it had a hurt leg or was somehow hurt. We called almost every number we could find who said they listed in Google who said they would help, but the only thing anyone could tell us was to just leave the baby raccoon there and let it wait for its mother. I was afraid it was hurt and that the dogs at the park would eat it, and someone told me if I got scent on the baby, its mother would deny it. What was the best thing to do in this situation?
Well, that's a good question. I think the fact that phone calls were made was a very good idea, particularly if the thought was that the animal had been injured. I'm sorry that she didn't get more satisfaction from the phone calls that were made. But if no phone call was available, nobody was willing to come and take the animal, I would leave the animal, alert the park personnel to what was going on, and see if they wouldn't at least try to get people to stay out of the area where this injured animal was. I would think that they might be willing to live trap the animal, but they might have wanted to wait a while for the mother to come back. Again, there are so many young animals that are brought to wildlife rehabilitators that really should have just been left.
Yeah. And what about that question about scent, though? Now, clearly you don't want to go around picking up wild animals, but if it's a tiny baby bird that you could put back in a nest, or a bunny that you could stick back in a hole, does the scent make a difference?
It doesn't really make a difference, particularly with birds. Birds have just about zero sense of smell or taste, and so it doesn't bother them at all. Certainly that is better than just leaving a bird that has fallen out of its nest out there on the ground where, again, anything can, even ants can attack the animal.
And she said, P.S., I did end up leaving her there in hopes that the mother would return, and she very well may have. Let's go back to the phones, 866-780-9100. Chad is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Chad.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm going back to the bat situation. I have a four-level split foyer, and I have now found two bats, one last spring and then one this fall. And I do believe they're coming down my old chimney because it's no longer being used. So I was wondering if the old wives' tale of, you know, mothballs, do those really help keep bats away from coming into your house?
Well, I certainly wouldn't use mothballs. I get this a lot from callers, and I tell them, you know, it's not a good idea. Those aren't good for your health. What would be a lot more effective and easier is to get a chimney cap that'll keep wildlife out of your chimney.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yep. Chad, thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Kathleen is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, I've been driving around Des Moines quite a bit, and this winter especially, I noticed the trees that have squirrel nests, and some trees have more than one. And then you go blocks and blocks without one squirrel nest, though you know squirrels are around. My question is, are there particular trees that squirrels like? And also, when you do see more than one nest in a tree, are those squirrels family related? Any data on that?
Boy, that's...
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Kathleen.
That's a great question, Kathleen. You know, I don't really know the answer to that, but you're going to make me do a little research and try to find out for you. I have assumed that in places where you have more than one nest in a tree, that perhaps that tree is particularly good in terms of being a place for squirrels to comfortably reside. You know, this is the season where they're using these leaf nests quite a bit, and you need to have an area or branches that are strong enough to support those leaf nests. So there in and of itself, size does matter. Probably the degree of branching and how close branches are to one another also plays into what is a good spot for a nest for a squirrel. The other thing would be proximity to... I really think this would be an interesting study to do in the city of Des Moines. Could have to do with proximity to bird feeders. As I always say to people, you know, when you feed birds, you also feed squirrels. And squirrels are fabulous at, no matter what you do, sort of outwitting you and getting to that bird seed. And I know that when I lived in South Bend, Indiana, I lived in a subdivision with lots of oak trees. And the squirrels were just incredibly resourceful in terms of getting to the folks who had feeders out back, and they would all hang around. They knew where that place was, and that's where they would have their nests as close to that as they could, because, you know, you snooze, you lose. So I wonder if that doesn't have something to do with that bunching effect.
I've also wondered if some of those nests are older nests.
Yes, you know, there is one thing that happens, and I get quite a few calls on this every year, where squirrels get, it's kind of like a mange, where they start losing their fur and everything, and it has to do with ectoparasites, little ticks or mites. It's actually a mite that is causing the problem. And of course, if you have an old nest, that is likely to just keep reinfecting the animal. So eventually they may build themselves a new nest that doesn't have the mites, particularly once they've been totally denuded from the process. And then they can recover. But yeah, those nests can get pretty grody.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for your call. Betty is up next on the line at 866-780-9100 in West Liberty. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I have a comment about snakes. Our garage was built on an abandoned cistern, and I was assured the cistern was filled up, but I'm wondering now if that's possibly wrong, because snakes appear in the spring, large bull snakes, in the warm days of spring or early summer, outside our front door. And I don't suppose anything can be done about it, because our garage is built over this abandoned cistern. But that might be helpful to the man who was wondering about the snakes on our patio. If there's an abandoned cistern nearby, could the snakes be going there in the wintertime?
They sure could. That's a very, very common overwintering place for snakes. And you bring up a good point. Your cistern is probably providing that overwintering place for the bull snakes, which I should mention, by the way, are great to have around in terms of rodent eaters. There was some study done like in 1978 in which it was demonstrated that they save agricultural producers about $800, you know, for each bull snake out on the landscape in terms of the grain that they save from rodents. So if that's 1978 dollars, you can probably do the math in 2012 dollars. They're great rodent control. But yeah, old cisterns, and oftentimes it'll be various species of snakes. He had both garter snakes and milk snakes. You may have something other than bull snakes that are using the area. When it comes to overwintering, these animals are quite slow and they're cold, and they're very tolerant of other species, whereas they aren't necessarily as tolerant during their active seasons.
I do think some people are shocked by the size that some snakes can be in Iowa. Bull snakes, for example, can be quite large.
They can be quite large. You know, they can get to be 5-6 feet long and as big around as a baseball. And so for a lot of folks, size alone can have a lot to do with their tolerance for these animals. But, you know, they're really fascinating. And what happens is they just go on to larger prey items. So maybe they're not going to eat mice, but they're going to eat rats or squirrels or something. But, you know, they really don't pose any threat to us. Just like any other wild animal, most people would never think to go up to a skunk and decide that they're going to make friends with it and pick it up or harass it. They sort of respect it, respect the fact that it's got this ability to stink them up, etc. Well, if we behaved in that same respectful manner towards snakes, we would find that we generally don't have any problem with these animals. It's when we approach them, make them feel threatened, get between them and their escape route, that they start getting defensive. But otherwise, they just assume you go your way and I'll go my way.
Betty, thank you so much for your call. We still have time for a couple more questions at 866-780-9100. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, and she's wondering how best to keep ground squirrels away from her motorhome. She has trouble with them going under and chewing on wires.
Yeah, you know, the best way with a motorhome that I found is to actually put down some fencing along around the perimeter of the motorhome and to bury it a bit underground so that the animals can't get in under there and be causing problems. They just love to gnaw and they will chew on all of those. What happens oftentimes is there are some things like salt or minerals that are apparent on these hoses and everything that make it really appealing. I'm not sure she has ground squirrels or chipmunks. A lot of people I find actually call chipmunks ground squirrels, but it's the same issue one way or the other, keeping them away from the area. You can try repelling them with an area repellent, and they do sell those at places like Lowe's or Home Depot. But the more permanent solution is just making that area unavailable to them.
So if you don't move the motorhome very often, that's a great solution.
Right, right. If you don't move the motorhome very often. If you're using it all the time, then you've got a little bit more of a challenge on your hands in terms of trying to keep the animals from getting at the wires.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We still have a few minutes for a couple more questions. Rebecca, what are the most common questions that you get?
I get an awful lot of snake questions, which really fascinates me because we don't really have a lot of quote-unquote problems with snakes. It just happens to be their utter presence for a lot of people is problematic. So I've tried to do a lot to promote those animals 2013 is the year of the snake. So, and if you go into even a Starbucks, their gift cards have a little snake on them because it's the Chinese year of the snake, as well as the Midwest the Partners in Amphibian and Reptile Conservation's year of the snake. I also get a lot of bat calls. I get a lot of groundhog calls, a lot of ground squirrel calls, particularly in the summer when you're trying to garden and you're finding that you need to share your garden with wildlife and trying to minimize the amount or the percentage, the what do they call that, the tariff that the wildlife is charging you on having a garden. And so trying to step people through the whole process of wildlife damage management. Unfortunately, a lot of times people are hoping that there'll be a silver bullet, one thing that they do, and that's going to solve the problem. And so I spend a lot of time talking about, you know, trying to catch an issue quickly and not wait to act on it, because a lot of times it can be a simple change in your behavior can minimize or even get rid of the problem encounter. It's not the animals themselves that are the problem. It's the behavior that the animal is engaging in, just like when you deal with children. So it's a matter of learning, you know, what do we need to do to give this animal the message that it's not okay to be doing this?
John is on the line from New Hartford. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a question about pocket gophers, the ones that always live underground and make the big mounds of dirt. I live across from a prairie preserve where there's hundreds of the pocket gophers, and I want to know if there's any way to keep them from coming over onto my land, because they do eat the prairie grasses and stuff that I try to get growing on my land. You know, I know I can dig down and try to trap them or poison them, but I'd rather just keep them over where they are now instead of doing all that.
Well, I can totally understand that. You know, part of the problem is that they're rodents, and so their populations increase pretty rapidly, particularly if there aren't a lot of animals eating them. So if that population is growing in size, it is demanding more land or habitat for the population to be supported with food and that. And so they're naturally going to try to be moving into other habitat that serves them well. And it sounds like you have that habitat. One of the things that might be helpful is if you have a fence line and if you can, at least in some places, try to bury some chicken wire down with a trencher and see if that doesn't help alleviate having these animals come by. I don't know if it's feasible or not. I don't know how large a piece of land you have, but that would be one way of actually trying to exclude them, make them unable to move their way over.
You know, a lot of people, of course, they want to get rid of a certain kind of creature. I'm sure you get a lot of calls like that. And a lot of people do want to try to use poisons. What do you say about that in most cases?
In most cases, I really, really discourage it. My main concern is to keep both people and wildlife safe. And though, you know, folks, I understand the frustration in that. At the same time, I really don't want people to be poisoning their own groundwater, you know, causing problems for themselves or their children, etc.
And the poison moves up the food chain as well, right?
Exactly. And so I really, really discourage that. I try to step people through all of the other options. And in fact, I'd rather have you trap something than be poisoning it.
Rebecca, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Rebecca Christoffel. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Iowans Gardens in Hollywood. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.